Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm the host of the show, Lori LeBay, and my mom had dementia for 30 years. So I've been there, done that, and get what you're going through. And our show is all about raising people's voices all around the world. For those who are living with a diagnosis, to families caring for them, to professionals, researchers, movie directors, songwriters, authors, and so much more. We want to give you hope and strategies to live fully and to be able to still find the joy when Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, you know, knocks on your door. Here at Alzheimer's Speaks, I consider us true talk radio. We typically fill an hour of honest, authentic conversation. We're not about sound bites. We're about giving you sound information. Now, today, before I introduce our guest, and I'm so honored to have Dr. Mann with us, I'm just going to do a couple of shout-outs to a few organizations. One is Jennifer Fitzpatrick, who has written the book Cruising Through Caregiving, and she is doing some webinars still through the end of August, and you can find more information by going to our homepage at Alzheimer's Speaks. You'll see a graphic. Just go ahead and click on that. I also want to give a shout-out to Stall Catchers. Stall Catchers is a game where you can actually play a game and analyze real life data for Alzheimer's research. And again, just go to alzheimerspeaks.com and you will find the graphic there that you can just click on and move forward with. Last I want to give a shout out to is the Memory Cafe Directory. David does such a great job with this. We are, I think, pushing over 700 memory cafes now in just really a short period of time, and he has organized them all. So you can find one for yourself and the one you're caring for with dementia. These groups are meant for you to go together. Again, just go to memorycafedirectory.com. And don't forget to check out all the resources we have at alzheimerspeaks.com. If you want to build a dementia-friendly community, if you're looking for a keynote speaker, I would love to talk with you. I'd also love to talk with you to see if maybe you're interested in being a guest on our show, because everybody has a story. So if you go to our main website, there's a big contact us at the top. Again, go to alzheimerspeaks.com, click on that, and give me a shout out, and we will have a conversation about your story and get you on the schedule. All voices are welcomed. We don't have to agree. We just have to agree to disagree in a polite, respectable fashion, because everybody's needs are different. Every person with dementia is different. Every care partner, every family, economic state, cultural background and needs. So we just want to make sure that we can help you in whatever fashion we can. Now, today we're going to have a great conversation with Dr. Molly Mann, and she is an adult and child psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, along with an author. She is on the faculty at the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science for Stanford School of Medicine, and her latest book is marvelous. It's called Whisper, Forget Me Not. And it's filled with poetry and paintings portraying her experiences that she has had while she's watched her husband struggle with dementia. So welcome, Dr. Mann. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Lori, for a nice introduction.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show for many reasons. One, I love your book. I think it's a very powerful, and I think it'll be very helpful for our listeners. But I also appreciate your background in, you know, psychology and this whole experience of how do we process our emotions and our feelings of major change going on in our life. So I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation. But before we dive too deep into that, can you just give our listeners a little background regarding your husband? Mm-hmm. Tell us his name, when you started seeing symptoms, and kind of where it's gone from there.
Okay. Yes, the Alzheimer's, it just creeped on us because it was like 2015. One day, my husband's name is William Stover. He's a professor of the international relations and political science at Santa Clara University here in the Northern California, the Bay Area. And so he's been teaching for many years. He's been receiving a lot of awards for being the best teacher. One evening in January of 2015, he came home and he said, "Mally, I don't know what's happening to me. I tell the class my first point and second, and I just can't remember. And this is a class that I've taught for many years, over 30 years. And I said, "Well, maybe you were tired or something was going on that particular day." Then again, he came back the same week on Wednesday, and again on Friday of that week, told me the same exact thing, that I cannot speak. I can't say what I want to say. So that's how it manifested itself. And before that, there was another episode that we were sitting at the dinner table with my colleague and his wife. That was about 6 months prior that we were talking and, you know, kind of chatting. And he talked to my friend's wife as if he was talking about me as a third person, yet I was sitting there next to him. And then my friend said, "What's going on? Why Bill acts like you're not there?" It just, I never imagined that this is a beginning sign of brain illness. And again, in retrospect, I put all of that together. It makes sense what was happening. So that's one item of interest. And of course, I was very devastated when I heard the news from the neuropsychologist who made an appointment, and she said that you must be present, and I knew something was wrong. That was hard. February, it was the month of February, first week. We went there, I remember the day, and that's, you know, when we heard that he does have beginning Alzheimer, maybe a mild degree of Alzheimer.
Wow, so you were able to get him...
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you were able to get him in fairly quickly for a diagnosis then from January to February in the same year,
yes.
2015? Wonderful.
Yes. In December of 2014, his neurologist said, "Why don't we just do a general exam?" So at that time, he said, "Well, he might have a mild cognitive impairment." So with that, I could have, you know, I was sort of okay. But when it turned and converted to Alzheimer, that was January. That was rather quick conversion. That's what happened. Yeah. And yeah.
Okay.
All the testing and
Okay. And do you mind sharing your husband's name with us? Is that comfortable for you?
His name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Lori. Yeah, his first name is William. Middle name is James. Last name is Stover, S-T-O-V-E-R. Yeah,
okay,
I go by different last name. Yeah, just professionally unknown.
Okay, I just thought if we're referring to him, I'd like to refer to him by name. That's all, out of respect. So thank you for sharing that. I think it just gives our audience a little better idea of where you're situated, where you're coming from. Can you tell our audience how Alzheimer's disease and other kinds of dementia actually impact and cause stress on family members and communities, and especially the care partners or spouses that are involved?
Yes, this is a major impact on the caregiver. and the family member, they don't know what they're up against. Then you gradually, in my case, I was, you know, single-handed. I had to take care of my career, and you know, it's been quite a rough road, and it's a rough journey, I must say. But it does have, it's like it's a cycle. The inner cycle, which is a more intimate relationship with the, you know, a spouse, and sometimes if it's a mother-daughter or father-son, or I'm sure you know that women are diagnosed a lot more. One out of three are men, and two out of three are women with diagnosis of Alzheimer's. But the caregiver, it's basically their family member initially, and then gradually they get some help, outside help. Nevertheless, even though there is a outside help, still the responsibility is really falls on your shoulder. In my case, I was the one who had to make sure to manage his day-to-day, week-to-week kind of, you know, calendar, figuring out who was coming to be his companion. At the beginning, it was basically hiring people to stay with him and go on a walk and do exercise and things like that. But then as it gets worse, the job of the hired care, it increases. And the same thing for the family member, myself as a spouse. So it was 5 years, gradual, little by little. It's, you know, he lost his function. And it's something we take it for granted, okay, like brushing your teeth or putting food in your mouth, you name it, or toileting, things like that. So, yeah, it's been a, you know, tough road. But it, again, depends who is in the picture. They will be impacted. In fact, the grief of the a process that starts happening out of the loss of the loved one, it is an ongoing grief. It doesn't stop while the person is alive. You just, you're witnessing what happens, and that's very difficult and very stressful. So it's not surprising to see all the illnesses that could come along. You know, people get sick.
Oh, I totally agree. That ambiguous loss, that ongoing of never knowing what's going to happen next and what's going to be lost. And then sometimes it pops back up and it's functioning again and then it's gone. And I mean, it's almost like the cup game, you know, with the acorn under the cup. You just don't know where it is there really isn't a straight line pattern. You know, there's that saying, everybody with dementia is different, but then also every care partner is different, every environment's different, every family's different. And so you add all those dynamics together, and it's like scrambled eggs, and you just don't know how things are going to turn out. Now, do you have children that were able to support and help you with that? I know some families have children that step up and others have children but they don't step up, or they do step up and complicate things. What was your situation?
Yeah, I've been in a support group. I heard the stories about how children start sometimes fighting with each other or have a whole different opinion. In my case, we have only one daughter, and she lives in Chicago, Illinois. And so she's married, had two little kids, and she's also a physician. So she's got her hands full, and she's very caring daughter. Of course, long distance makes it difficult. You know, she does try to come and give me my moral support, and we talk on the phone, you know, that kind of thing. So she does understand me, what I'm going through. But, you know, there are different composition, you know, family structure could be quite different for everyone. As you just said, every case is very, very different. So there's no two cases of Alzheimer's is the same. As far as the support system goes, it's, yes, my daughter And then I have friends that they give me support. And I have one sister who lives about an hour away from me, and she has a very highly responsible job, and I don't expect that she would drop everything. But, you know, she's right in the background and helps and talks to me, and it's good. Yeah, I can't complain.
Yeah, it's important to be connected, and but sometimes I know families have a hard time explaining their journey and what's really happening, especially in the earlier stages, because people say, well, they look perfectly fine. They sound perfectly fine. They're, you know, because when mm-hmm. you're getting together many times with friends, you're reminiscing about the past, and they're not seeing
right.
the inability to maybe track or, you know, the executive functioning items or even just the grooming, how you're, I know I hid that with my own mother, and my dad had brain cancer. I'd go over there and I'd fix them all up and make sure they were all, you know, great to walk out the door. So they looked all pulled together, but they couldn't have done it on their own. I'll give you an example. My dad, for example, didn't have dementia, but at the end with his brain cancer was a little more confused, and a friend of theirs passed away. And so another friend mm-hmm. said, we'll come over and pick you up. And so they picked my dad up and my mom. And here's my dad in a suit, and all he has is an undershirt on. He doesn't have a shirt. And they took him out like that because they didn't know how to approach it. And so my dad is always, you know, kind of a jokester. And so I guess at the wake, somebody said, hey, Dean, you know, trying to trend a new style. And my dad just kind of joked along with it and, you know, didn't realize it either. But I just thought, oh, my goodness, you know. I think that was a startling moment when people said, oh, things are changing. You know, the brain's not quite working the way it is. And I think so often people have to almost be slapped by that crisis or severely conflicted situation that wouldn't normally happen with that person before they're willing to believe that something is wrong, because nobody wants to believe. How can people focus on the remaining skills of the person living with dementia? So often we focus on what's lost. How did you make that shift yourself, or how do you recommend people, you know, look for the positives of what remains and what is still with you?
Yeah, well, that goes back to what, you know, your own attitude, your approach to the illness. And so if you want to focus on the positives, then that would help the patient, no doubt. But in a way, one would have to do a lot of different modification of their environment where they live, you know, and making it simple. And then there's a communication that they can't expect, the full communication they're used to have. So whatever they can communicate with words, one would have to kind of live by and basically accept that and make sense of it. You know, and it's not just words to communicate, the bodily language. Even now, my husband is a very advanced stage of dementia. He does communicate, facial communication. It's just very fascinating. You know, when I see with his eyes, or he rolls, he follows, and he shows joy. If he's in pain, he has grimace. So, I mean, we have to rely on the other things besides words. So that's one thing we learn as a caregiver, particularly when you're living with someone. You know, we are the best people who know the person, right? And so that way we will make changes as we go along. You know, and one peculiar thing about Alzheimer's is, like, you know, there are some stages, it's not linear. You know, some of the deficit happens, you know, early on, but then there's something from stage 3 or 4 pops in stage 1, or vice versa, stage 1, and make it look like, oh, they must be just fine, they look okay, they carry a conversation, but they don't know the full picture. You see, that creates a confusion for people who don't know, who haven't had experience of being around a person with dementia.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the answer to your question is that one would have to know that the communication remains possible, that we don't want to highlight the words that they fail to communicate. We want to use the word that they use, and then kind of trying to reinforce that, and not too much focusing on the losses, but the one that's remained, and that one could make do with that, so to speak. And the remaining skills also, let's say walking, and he wasn't able to walk, but I tried to get the walker, and I would try to hold his hand. And earlier on, we would go for a short walk. So until March of this year, I would take him with me to the gym, and I would just be his coach, you know, because he couldn't remember whether he has what he had to do, how to turn the machine on, or, you know, the cardiovascular thing. So I was doing this coaching. So that's, you know, that takes a lot of motivation, and you have to really be positive about it. And, you know, they need physical exercise. We all know that how exercise helps the circulation in the brain, and it postpones to some extent, you know, so that's one thing that his neurologists that emphasize, and I know as a physician that how important it is. He early on said that, Mally, make him go to the gym, go with him, exercise if you can every day. So I couldn't go every day, but because of my workload, but I would go maybe 3 to 4 times a week, which wasn't too bad. And so I've done that. I think that I would encourage the audience who are having a loved one with dementia of any kind, you know, it's like exercise, physical activity is very important, stimulating the brain with different games, and helping them how to make sense of things, because, you know, they are living in a confused state of mind, and you don't want to barrage them with too much stimulation. On the other hand, too little of it is not good either. So one would have to really go step by step and figure out how they're taking it, whether they're enjoying it or not. And if it's too much and tiresome, you have to stop it. Yeah,
I think that's very important for us to read their nonverbals and listen to their verbals when they're able to communicate with us in that fashion. I remember with my mom, as she progressed, she loved music and she loved to dance, and we used to stand up and dance, and then as she progressed, it was with the walker, and then it was with the wheelchair, and then we just kind of arm danced, sitting down, and then we got down to just pinky dancing with our fingers. But she still had this beautiful smile and this joy, because it was this intimate connection that we still had. You know, it was still bodies touching and moving together and feeling that, just that inner sense of having somebody else be there for you, and I felt that from her as well. It was not one-sided. I think a lot of people think caregiving is all giving it away, but you will receive from them when you start looking for the right things. One of the things I want to talk about is, how does one still communicate with a loved one who has a degenerative brain illness? And before I have you answer that, I just wanted to read one of your poems here that I think is just powerful, and it's called Moving Mouth. Moving mouth, moving more and more with no sound coming out. Moving mouth again and again, at last a word. Malas, I know you tried to say my name. A second time you called me again our cat's name. My beloved, I am not your cat. I am your wife, Molly, not Malas. Both of our eyes tear up. I just think that that's so powerful, because they're trying so hard to connect, and sometimes the words just don't come out the way way we want them to. So how did you, you know, as the disease progressed, how did you learn to communicate with your husband?
Well, we all need to kind of come up with some kind of an examination of how we have to do a bit of a guess game. What they're thinking, what they must be feeling, how they communicate verbally, non-verbally, And what they do to compensate to make us understand what they're feeling. And we have to, and how they also have reaction to the change in them. So they can feel early on, at least, the deficits. And so that could be depressing. And, you know, so that's why the caregiver task is very crucial, how one would stay and you know, positive and figuring out to improve the understanding of all these clues that you have at your disposal and to make things work. And that your positive attitude, it does affect the patient's way of thinking about himself. 5 years of this illness, now it's an advanced stage. Maybe twice he had tears in his eyes, and I could feel that he was frustrated, and I don't remember exactly what we were trying to do, and I know he realized that he couldn't do it, and that was very hard on him. What I have done, I hope I'm answering your question, but in terms of communication, so I try to travel with him. So I did as best as I could, you know, we go international travel, and also nationally for his job and my job and all of that. But, you know, until last summer, we did every summer, we took it a trip to Europe. And last summer was to Japan. I had to present a case, a paper. And people thought, wow, they raised their eyebrow. What are you going to do, Mel? You know, I said, well, I took him with me. I managed him in the airplane, managed him in the conference. He was a kind of a quiet type. I do understand there are some Alzheimer's that are really belligerent and really make life very difficult, much more difficult. But my husband is more of on a quiet side. So it worked just fine. And I was happy to have him with me. Because for me, it's a big loss. Because as a couple, we've done all those things. And, you know, taking him with me, it was satisfying for me. And I'm sure it was satisfying for him because I was with him. It's a familiar face and we were doing things, fun. Walking, short walk, things like that. So I'm not saying that this is good for everyone, but at that time he was able to walk. And it comes March 22nd, I come home and the caregiver says, I can't get him up, he can't move. So that's how sudden it was, the change. So since we haven't, you know, how could we travel anywhere? That has stopped it in December of last year. So I try to keep him active and myself active because that helps me also feel more optimistic, not unrealistically optimistic, but just realistically taking things that are, you know, positive and not to dwell on a negative part and losses, you know. Otherwise, there are mm-hmm. plenty of that.
Yeah, I speaking of travel, I have to give a shout out. I work with a dementia-friendly group here in Roseville, Minnesota, and we are working with the University of Minnesota, and we've put together a dementia-friendly airport survey that's open till September 15th of 2019. And again, you can go to alzheimerspeaks.com. It's right on the top. Just click on it. It'll bring you right to it. But it's for people that can complete it that are in the earlier stages of the disease and their travel companions. We want feedback from both. You can be anywhere in the world. Initially, we thought it would be Minnesota specific, and we just decided this is such a great need that we need to go broader. Also with the travel, you know, I love that you brought your husband, William, with you because it is an important part of our lives, and it's something that care partners and families don't want to lose. By any stretch, and it's you know, we need to make that more viable. In 2017, I did a dementia-friendly cruise for people with dementia and their care partners, and we just had a marvelous response to that. And there, Lisa Chinova is doing it now. I don't know if I'll do another one or not. There are a ton of work, but if anyone mm-hmm. is looking for direction in terms of where to go and a referral, please reach out to me. I'd be more than glad to assist you with that. the group that we had together actually got together themselves this year without any formal conference or symposium and just said, hey, we can do this on our own, and we're going to. And they went as a group. So it was a bunch of people from a memory cafe, but they were empowered to say, we can do this. And we need to come up with solutions like that for people. You know, the other thing that you had mentioned when you were talking about communication and the progression, you know, how everybody is a little bit different. I think one of the things that we need in this world, dementia or not, is to get people to start reading nonverbals. You had made the comment of, you know, they can pick up on your emotions, you know, when you walk in. And a lot of times they'll mirror that back to us, and we think we've covered it all up, and then we say they have the problem, and they were perfectly content till we came in with our anxiety or stress or whatever it is, and then they mirror it back. They don't lose that ability to read our nonverbals. And in fact, most of them tell me that they have a heightened sense of awareness of reading lips and watching for nonverbals, because they can't always string the words together. And so I think it's teaching us that we have to slow down and be much more conscious of all the ways we communicate, because over 3/4 of our communication is nonverbal, but we always seem to take a stand with a person with dementia and want those words forced to come to us, and to come to us in the proper order, or whatever order we think is proper, and then get disappointed when they're not able to. So I believe so much in that, and I don't know if you found this to be true, but well, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add what you're saying. Agreeing with what you say. I mean, the communication part, we can't expect a complex thing, communication. So the rule of that, to make it simple, rule of simplicity, short sentences, and also the tone of voice that you use. I'm sure it will convey, hopefully, compassion, love, and that's very important. And they respond. And we can use our own nonverbal, meaning touching. Touching is very important. Touching, it calms them down. And it's so important to put your hand on the, you know, chest area where the heart is, you know, holding it quietly. And that's kind of a meditative moment. It helps both care partner and also the patient. It's very important to pay attention to that nuances, because they pick that up. They, you know, and the other thing is that I want to say, Lori, you said it earlier about the importance of music. My husband would have been a conductor in his other life, because he plays piano. He played the piano, I should say, guitar and a number of other things, wind instrument. So he really cheers up when I, you know, have music played. He loves it because it's from past, those memory from the past, as you know, it comes back, because he reacts to that, the response, and it's really very useful. Okay, I don't mean you have to be a conductor, but we all love music, you know. So music was a big part of his life. That's what I'm trying to say. And so bringing it back into the picture, it really helps a lot. His mood.
I totally agree. And, you know, when we think about it, I think we take music for granted, yet we hop in the car and we turn it on, and it can make us laugh. It can make us cry. It can make us smile. It can, you know, it can trigger so many different moods. And it's such a powerful tool that is used to really ignite the brain. There's a company called All's Music Connect, and they have a kind of a hidden patented technology within their music that you can't tell. It's just gorgeous music. But when people listen to it, I believe it's like they connect on a higher level for typically, like, I want to say it's 3 or 6 hours. I can't remember the specifics totally on the data. But it is amazing. And, you know, when you think about it, whenever we're, meaning any of us, are in a more content state, we're going to be more connected. You know, we're yes. going to be more engaged because we're not going to have all of those arrows poking at us that we're, you know, we're scared of something or we're worried about being judged or, you know, being right or wrong. All of those things that can just frighten us and stifle us at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think people need to understand the importance of one being content. Harry Urban is a man who's been living with dementia about 15 years. And one of, I think, he says so many just stunning things, but I'll never forget when he said, you know, I like to relax before I got dementia. I still do. Instead of keeping me busy, because that makes you feel like you're doing something, just sit with me. And, you know, smell the flowers, feel the breeze against your face, the sun shining on your body, but just absorb the peacefulness. When they're peaceful, take that moment to grab it for yourself as well, instead of just this busy work. And I know as a daughter, I followed my checklist and I was, you know, there was so much for me to do, but I did learn eventually, it took me longer than I would have liked, that a lot of my checklist was busy work because I just so yes. wanted to do a good job. And I lost my personal connection. And then when I you know, grabbed it back and said, hey, this is why I'm doing this to begin with, is my relationship. Then my relationship with my mom went to multiple levels of unconditional love I didn't know existed. And at the end, it was like a spiritual relationship. I mean, we were connected
yes.
at such a high, beautiful level that it was, I can't even put it into words. And it's one
I know,
of those
it's
things
indescribable.
Yeah, and you don't want anyone to miss out on that, but people have to slow down to find it. You know, you don't need any words when you can just end up relaxing and sitting next to somebody in silence. And when I go out and speak, you know, I talk to people about that and say how often, you know, we revel in sitting next to somebody we love, just that peacefulness. And it is so vitally important. I want to switch gears just a little bit, Dr. Mann, and talk
yes.
about with your husband's Alzheimer's yes. disease. How did that inspire you to communicate, you know, yourself through poetry and painting, you know, in this book, Whisper, Forget Me Not?
Yes, but I used to write poetry, but I felt like last 5 years there was this inner drive that I wanted to put words in the poetry form rather than writing in prose. And I think it's the byproduct of this, in my opinion. And so I feel like it's very hard to express some of the feeling that you go through as a caregiver. And at least for me, was, you know, I think you also concurred with that, like you were talking about how you've reached to a level of intimacy and closeness with your mom. So that itself, it's indescribable. It's not possible to put forward. And through poetry writing, I get closer to that. I'm not saying I'm fully successful, but at least I get myself to write things that that's inside, okay, in a poetic way. And that helps me to calm down, and also I feel like I'm expressing it. And whereas I didn't feel like I had anybody who could understand me, or if they did, you know, it was fine, but I also needed an additional way of expressing my inner thoughts and feelings. So that's how, you know, it just evolved. It wasn't like one day I said, okay, I'm going to write poems now. It just, you know, developed into that. And pretty soon I said, well, I've got collections of poems related to this illness. And so I did dedicate the book to my husband. And he, too, used to write poems in the past. We would read to each other in the past. So it was actually this year, it was in March or maybe April, the book got published, and so I did take the book and showed it to him. He was just so ecstatic. He showed his excitement through his body language, face. And then what he said, I never forget. I remember that. I thought that was incredible, the word. He doesn't say much. But the book, the cover of book, because I used to talk to him, let's say 2 years ago, I said, well, I'm going to write and collect these poetries. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. At that time, he was able to put some sentences together. But when I showed the cover of the book, he said, I remember that. He said that. It was just amazing what he managed to say that. I think it really brought some emotion in him. He managed to say a couple of words. Ironically, it's like, whisper, forget me not. And he says, I remember that. So it's all about forgetting and remembering. But he managed to say, I do remember that you started this writing project. And here it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, it's absolutely beautiful. Do you mind maybe sharing with our audience a couple of your favorite poems out of the book, Whispers, Forget Me Not?
Okay. Let me see. I think there's one which is Silence. Silence. Breakfast in silence. Lunch in silence. Dinner in silence. Silent day, silent night, no words. People who know you ask how you are. Does he talk to you? I say yes. You understand what I say and what you want to say. People look worried about you. You eat your meal with no sound and no eye contact. The man who watches you found it strange. Not knowing what to say or how to act. Is this the question now? Should I go by myself? So this shows some of the changes that one experiences. But, you know.
Yeah. And, have you noticed the loss of apathy with your husband at all?
Meaning not showing the feeling or apathetic. It's more like a mask face at times. But something that really makes a difference for him, somehow it kicks in from the past. His neurons in the brain is firing up. Then he responds with a smile and acknowledgement. And that's the look of familiarity, look of being understood. So that comes true. I don't mean all day long it's that, but you know, moments like that. And I cherish mm-hmm. those moments.
Yeah. I think it's really important for people to understand that that old process. And again, everybody is a little bit different. But I remember talking with Dina Dotson, who had young onset, and she said, she was still able to communicate with people, and people thought she looked normal. And mm-hmm. her husband still wanted her to run the business. Her kids still wanted her to do all the momly things she's always done. And I remember her saying one time in our dementia chats, which is a video conversation I facilitate with panelists that all are diagnosed. And she says, I can't explain it other than to tell you that there's nothing worse for a person with dementia to look at a picture of their own children, knowing mm-hmm. that they should feel this exuberant love for them. And you have, there's nothing. She says, there's just nothing.
Yes.
And she says, and you feel this great guilt, when you're mm-hmm. when you're aware that this is happening, for not being able to have those feelings. But it's just the way the brain is wired at that time. And so for us sometimes to add guilt to the fire of which they are already feeling guilty and remorseful over – You know, they don't deserve that. They deserve so much better from us because it's not yes. something that they're trying to do in any stretch. Did you find humorous moments?
I just wanted to say something quick. I think our concepts of the guilt and embarrassment are a bit different, and they may feel something. What we don't know was their version of feeling, what they feel. I think early on or middle stage dementia, those could be detected. But later on, as you said, you know, you show the photo, this kind of a blank look. You know they can't make out what who these people are in the photo. That's very true. So you were going to ask about humor, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And if that, I know for myself and in our family, we always used humor a lot. And that was, there were some people that would say, oh, you can't laugh at that situation. And it's like, I would if they didn't have dementia, and they would too, you know. So we're not going to give, we're not going to give that up in our family. But I know some people, when they're around anyone who's ill, they don't feel it's appropriate to laugh. And yet I think it's one of the most natural bonding things that we have that can yes. lift our spirits and change our body chemistry and the whole nine yards to give us
Absolutely.
Hope. What are your thoughts about laughter and humor?
Well, if then you come up with some emotional reserve, I should say, when you do all the chores and groundwork, and, you know, hopefully you get some help to do that. But that there is a room for the humor. And it's good for you, for the caregiver, care partner. When you are cheerful or you're laughing, that is contagious. And I think does affect the mood, the Alzheimer's patient. So, you know, pretty soon, you know, I see a smile if I laugh about something. Up to about almost a year ago, we would watch together Seinfeld and Big Bang Theory. So I don't know how much he was getting it, but he did laugh. Not I was laughing a whole bunch more, of course, but his level of laughing because of the illness had diminished, but still he was laughing. Not bad. So it was something to share. Yeah.
Well, and again, sometimes they will mimic whatever we're doing back. And, you know, right. laughter is a lot better than anxiety or anger, you know, or, you know, not such a good temperament. So I think that there's definitely a plus with all that. I just interviewed somebody on laughter yoga, and they really got into, you know, how the body doesn't know the difference between real laughter and fake laughter, but all of the chemical changes that happen
yes.
within our body and how healthy that is. And, you know, my mom's been gone now 5 years. And when I go out and I speak, and I mean, I tell stories, I get people laughing, but I get them crying too. And it's just, you know, it's we shouldn't give up any of our emotional states because we're dealing
yes.
with dementia. You know, it's not our emotions that are good or bad. It's how we react to them, which you well
Absolutely.
Know, but I think sometimes, you know, we feel embarrassed or uncomfortable showing certain emotions. And, I think that's part of what's wrong with society as a whole right now that's gotten us in such a mess. People aren't expressing themselves, and then they're kind of exploding internally. And you know, it's just not healthy for us from a mental health standpoint at all, I don't think. So I encourage people, laugh. You know, you don't want to be laughing at somebody with dementia. You want to be laughing with somebody with dementia, but realize the gift that is. Is there another poem that you'd like to share with us, Dr. Mann?
Yeah, I have a couple, but let me see. What I have one titled Remembering, Forgetting, Remembering. Forgetting our childhood, remembering how to remember, not forgetting to remember. I insist how to. If I size the moment in a picture, if I said in word, if I held your hand and insist to remember the moment, would you? If I write the words, it could help. I ask you today if you know the name of the place we were together, no was your response. The look on your face told me the same, that you can't remember yesterday. You did not know where you were. Palpable sorrow greets me at the door. And so this is time that you discover that, you know, you ask a question, it's lost. So this is the moment that you can't really share. So particularly mm-hmm. for the spouse, it's very, you know, difficult time to get introduced. It's how this illness is so cruel. It just, bit by bit, it takes over. And so it takes over and you can't really do much. And you can't reverse it. And so you've got to learn how to deal with this incremental loss on a daily basis.
Agree. One of the things I think that is just such an important poem, but something that just came to my mind was something that Susan Sessions said, and she's since passed from dementia, but she talked mm-hmm. about memories, and something that I think families do so often is we will we'll declutter. We'll get rid of their stuff, their mm-hmm. collectibles, thinking that we're helping simplify things. But one of the things she pointed out was she said, what you have to realize when you're decluttering is that what you see as clutter or junk might be mm-hmm. triggering a wonderful memory for me. And so when you yes. toss that out, now you're blatantly taking my memories away and they're already slipping from us. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be really careful when that occurs, or if someone has to make a move, trying to figure out what truly is important, what will give them peace, what will bring them happiness. And we should be having those conversations early on. Susan actually wrote notes on the back of items saying when she bought it, why she bought it, and what it meant to her. So before oh. somebody tossed it, they would see that, which I thought was really a brilliant thing to mm-hmm. do. But she said it didn't work in mm-hmm. all cases. Sometimes they just toss too. You know, mm-hmm. with that. Well, our time is just about up here, and I want to make sure that that people know how to get a hold of you. They can
yes.
email you at mailimannd as in dog at gmail.com. That's md at gmail.com. And we also
all
have a link
case.
To all lowercase. And we also have uh-huh. a link where they can go and get your book on Amazon as well. Mm-hmm. And so, again, the book is called Whisper, Forget Me Not. And, again, beautiful, beautiful poetry and lots of wonderful art in here. So it's a full color book, and I think one that will just resonate with just about anybody, I think, who picks this up. It's very important. You capture so many brilliant moments in just a few words, you know, with your poetry in terms of, you know, the experience and things that you have. You've got one titled Last Visit. On my mm-hmm. way to the airport, you rushed to see me off. I knew this was the last time. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it just, you know, yeah. you don't need a lot of words sometimes for us to be able to feel what it's like. And again, I thank you so much for sharing your world with us and your life with your husband and your experiences and your professional information as well, you know, in terms of processing mm-hmm. our emotions. Any last tips or advice that you'd like to give? We've got about 2 minutes left.
Okay, the advice is stay true with your own emotion. Try not to hide it from yourself and try to articulate what they might be. And also be prepared for the grief reaction, grief that is, you know, makes it more complicated kind of grief. But nevertheless, I think it's possible to do that when, you know, also getting some support, you know, stay with the caregiver support weekly, and they have everywhere in the Bay Area, and I'm sure nationwide. So that would be helpful because you don't feel like you're alone. There are other people who are dealing with difficult situations like that.
Exactly. Well, again, Dr. Mann, thank you so much for your time and
sharing
your world with your husband, William, with us. And again, your book, Whisper, Forget Me Not. And again, I just feel honored to have you on the show. For our audience, please spread the word, you know, like, click, share. I think this will be a helpful episode for people to listen to. I think this book will be a great one for people to pick up to give them some peace and calm and know that they're not alone with their emotional swings through the journey. And again, check us out at alzheimerspeaks.com. That's alzheimerspeaks.com, two S's in the middle. We have all kinds of free resources there, and we would love to assist you any way we can. I also want to give a shout out to the Alzheimer's Research and Prevention Foundation. They deal with the disease from a holistic fashion. So exercise, diet, meditation, just go to alzheimerspreventionprevention.org. That's alzheimerspreventionprevention.org. Have a blessed week, everyone, and thank you again. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.